This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
It's great to have as our guest this morning Mr. Bill Buford. Bill is a writer for LouRockwell.com, and his articles on the subject of secession have caused a lot of interest among readers and in the broader world. And Bill, you know, if we listen to the enemies of secession, the people who say that you're an evildoer for even mentioning the idea that you're some sort of terrorist, maybe you're a slaveholder, but I think you've helped show us that secession is an important component of freedom.
Well, you know what, to put it in the simplest terms, secession is basically a divorce. And if we really simplify it, let's suppose that you have a friend or I have a friend who happens to be in a relationship that is terminally irreconcilable. They don't get along for whatever reason we can come up with. So they seek a divorce as a couple. Well, they go to the authorities and they say, we'd like to formalize a divorce and separate ourselves legally. And the response is not, here's the papers for your divorce. The response is, if you ever come to us again with that request, we will fine you, jail you, maim you, or kill you, and you will remain with that person no matter what damage it does to you because we say so.
Well, you know, we had several attempts at secession in America. We had, of course, the successful secession from the British Empire, although they don't like to call that a secession. But, of course, it was a secession because, unlike, say, in a civil war, the American side in the American Revolution was not attempting to take over London and depose the king. We simply wanted to be left alone. It's why the War of 1861-1865 is not properly described as a civil war either, because the South did not want to take over Washington and run Wisconsin. Again, they just wanted to be left alone.
They wanted a partition.
They wanted a partition. There's a movement today, isn't there, both within states and regions, states themselves, all over this country, Republic of Vermont and the South and the West, people are thinking and talking about secession.
Well, I think it's huge. I'm surprised to see at just the level of people interacting with each other on a daily basis and speaking to each other, it's become accepted in polite conversation to even discuss it. Well, not only that, but now we have legislators in Montana, in Idaho, in Arizona. You name the states, I think there's 20-some-odd on the books as far as sovereignty resolutions, those kind of things, where even the legislators are doing that. And I think the legislators are doing that probably because they feel the time is right, and they may be getting input and requests from their constituents that we need to put D.C. back on the blocks where they belong.
Of course, sometimes people assume that, gee, if there's a secession, then we're no longer all Americans. But certainly it's been shown, for example, in Germany before the horrible centralization began, where they had, I think, 600 political subdivisions, all of them independent, but everybody was a German. They all spoke German. They had a German culture. Same is true in this country. If we had that political divorce, if we allowed states and subdivisions in the spirit of Ludwig von Mises, who always said that no people or part of a people should be held in a political association it does not want. So that's the simple principle of classical liberalism, as he expressed it early in the last century. And that's always been the principle of freedom. So here we are, Americans talking about this, and I think you're exactly right. When the governor of Texas, and I thought it was extremely interesting that Rick Perry felt it was in his political interest as a sitting Republican governor to mention the idea of Texas seceding from the Union and running its own affairs and not being oppressed by Washington, he actually got away with it. Yes, there was criticism of Ron Paul when he agreed with the governor of Texas, but nothing like what it was in the past. I mean, it's absolutely true that there was a period of time, obviously having to do with the results of the War of the 1860s, that it was highly politically incorrect, I mean, virtual hate speech to talk about this subject, no longer. So does this represent just a change in our heads, or does it, do you think, represent a potential actual change on the ground?
I think it's a change on the ground. And mind you, I think this change has been brought to us also as a result of the economic calamities that are emanating from D.C. Their mismanagement, their Sovietization of the United States, their attacks on our civil liberties and things like that. I mean, one thing I mentioned in one of my essays was that little did I know, and I came to this conclusion just recently, that in 1917, V.I. Lenin and Woodrow Wilson were in an ideological foot race to find out who could put together the perfect Soviet Union. And we got the gold medal. We won. The Soviets lost. And I think that people are starting to react to that, and they're starting to wake up and say, you know, We have this economic calamity. We have this attack on our civil liberties. We're making war on the world. Of what benefit is it to us, as normal, everyday Americans living in our communities, to behave in this fashion and to have people behave towards us in this fashion? I think people are just getting fed up.
Although, you know, we all used to make fun of the old Soviet constitution as having no meaning. But I do notice that when they dissolved the Soviet Union heroically, that they stuck to the Soviet constitution, and those areas of the Soviet Union that were deemed to be independent republics became independent. And there was actually very little debate about it. Whereas our own constitution would certainly at least implicitly allow secession. Nobody pays attention to that.
I agree with you that our constitution implicitly allows secession to occur because it doesn't mention it, and it is a document of negative liberties. As a matter of fact, if I recall, there were several attempts in the 1840s, 50s, after the nullification crisis in 1832, in which they were trying to say, not only can you not secede, but we're going to formalize that language because the Constitution does not address it. I mean, they were talking about an amendment, I think, in 60 or 61 to the Constitution to ban secession, and of course that begs the question, doesn't it?
Also, interestingly enough, as Tom DiLorenzo has pointed out, Lincoln proposed a 13th Amendment, not the 13th Amendment we're familiar with today that abolished slavery, but an amendment that would have made slavery permanent wherever it existed in the United States and unabolishable. The South wouldn't accept it. And interesting that for Lincoln, secession, of course, far trumped questions of slavery. To him, the Union had some sort of mystical content. And it must be kept together. No one must be allowed to leave. And if, as you pointed out, if you do allow to leave, we can kill you.
Yeah, and of course, we can see the bloodshed that was shed as a result of that. And I also think that, and I'm a big fan of DiLorenzo, by the way. I mean, he really opened my eyes to a lot of things I hadn't previously known, is that a lot of people say, well, FDR, who I like to call Red DR, and Woodrow Wilson, inaugurated what we presently have as this managerial, centralized state that's almost Soviet in nature. And I've come to the conclusion that Lincoln is the author of that. Maybe some people can say, yeah, we're suffering under Hamilton's curse to a certain extent. I agree with that. But I think Lincoln was the one who really solidified not only our inability to escape from this centralized prison that we find ourselves in today, but to give it a bad name to secession. And, you know, as you very well know, there is a huge Lincoln apology culture out there in the universities, from left to right.
No, it's true, and that's the reason, as you pointed out, about Lincoln in effect being the founder of the current American regime. It's the reason that it's far more controversial to criticize Lincoln than any other American president. Even beloved presidents like FDR or Wilson or LBJ can be criticized. Lincoln is a godhead. He may not be criticized. And as you say, he is the founder of the regime. I always thought the French were a little more honest than we are in numbering the republics. When there was a significant change, the first, the second, third, fourth, fifth republic. What are we in? We're the third or the fourth or fifth American republic. I mean, it's very different after FDR. It's different maybe after Bush, certainly different after Wilson, and really different after Lincoln.
And by the way, we are laboring under our fourth variation of the Federal Reserve.
Well, so, yeah. That's correct. And of course, the most damaging one.
Absolutely.
Doing things
and
right now.
I like to say that Lincoln put us all on the plantation.
Well, Lincoln was a big paper money guy and issued the greenbacks, started the income tax. Well, Tom DiLorenzo showed us all the inheritance tax. Many wonderful things we can thank Abe Lincoln for when you visit his temple
yeah.
there in Washington and worship him. By the way, the,
yeah.
the Lincoln Memorial in Washington is a copy of what they think was the temple to Jupiter Best and Greatest on the Capitoline Hill in ancient Rome, and Jupiter was the chief god of the Roman state. So it's appropriate that Lincoln is there in his throne with the fascis decorating it and looking like Jupiter. Yeah, and looking like Jupiter as the chief god of the American state.
You know, Lou, it's a brilliant segue when you mention the Greeks and the Romans, because I happen to think that the Greek city-states had a notion of carrying capacity to avoid tyranny, in which they thought that, and let's put a hypothetical number to it, if you go over 100,000 people that are under one political confabulation or whatever organization they put themselves under, communist, capitalist, whatever they want to call it, that beyond that point, when it is centralized, it has a tendency to tyranny that is absolutely inevitable. And I think that that's what's happened to a certain extent with us today in America, is that from east to west, north to south, we are this one nation, and we have been laboring under this Lincolnian, Wilson, Red DR creation where the states are not so much sovereign 9th and 10th Amendment capable individual entities, but they are simply the agents of the central government's will, and if they refuse to abide by that will, they're going to come into harm's way in some fashion in which the state will be told, you'll do this or else.
And Bill, small entities like you describe have been discussed by Hans Hermann Hoppe in his great book, Democracy, the God That Failed. And he points out that one of the benefits, one of the adjacent benefits of small entities, political entities like this, is that it's impossible for them to be protectionist. They have to engage in free trade, because if they are protectionist, they'll all starve to death. And so you can't have the kinds of economic policies in the trade area that you're able to have with a massive internal market like the United States. So there's more freedom in every sense in these small entities.
A heavily regulated market, mind you, which is why we've become. I mean, think of it as my vision of secession is, I think that once it begins, once one state, and Montana's really fired a shot over the bow with the Agency for Tobacco Firearms Regulation, the ATF, which is now the ATFE, where they said that all firearms that are created by Montanans, sold to Montanans, and remain within Montana borders will no longer be subject to the 1934 NFA, 1968 GCA, and all the other federal gun laws and the ATF. It's really kicking sand in the tyrant's face to do that. They must respond in some fashion, and I think that that may be the point at which we'll see some kind of movement as far as somebody really taking hold and saying, you know, as governor of my state and looking at my 9th and 10th Amendment provisions in the Constitution and my ability to act on those, maybe it's time for us to step forward and say enough is enough.
I always like to remember that I always like to think of them as the BATF, and I guess now that the BATFE, the BATFE,
yeah,
or whatever, is the agency that ran the prohibition in the teens and the 20s and the early 30s, ran the alcohol prohibition. So this has been a group that's been engaged in bad stuff for a very, very long time. And, of course, one of the chief gun control agencies, too.
Well, they have a terrible reputation for abusing citizens. And there's case after case, like the recent Olofsson case that you can look at, where they really cooked the books technically on getting him in jail on false charges and such. But you can find that stuff within the gun community. But I think that kind of thing, I think it was Wickard versus Allison in the 1930s, and you may correct me on this, Lou, is where the United States said, well, commerce occurred there because he had the potential to sell that wheat to somebody, even though he didn't, and consumed it himself.
That's true. This was a farmer in Illinois who was growing wheat on his own farm and consuming the wheat that he grew in bread and so forth on his own farm. And he refused to go along with Roosevelt's agricultural regulations and said that these don't apply to me because I'm not engaged in interstate commerce. And you're right, the government held that, the government courts held that he might have sold it to somebody in another state. And therefore,
it should apply to him.
Maybe
one of the legal ruses that they will use to fight the Montana governor's initiative on firearms within a state, among other legal ruses, which brings me to another point of observation, is that I think we have to stop paying attention to federal laws if we're going to say that we're serious about secession, because it's those very federal laws that have caused these notions of secession to start in the first place, not only today, but for hundreds of years. I mean, in 1945, the UN had 50 nations. Now we have 195 nations. If you look over the five millennia plus of recorded human history, Western, and I'm not familiar with a lot of Eastern history, but in Western history, we've had secession after secession after secession because empires die, of course, and break apart. But secession comes from natural ethnic and creed conclaves saying, you know, we need to calve ourselves and be midwife from this big glacial state because we can't work with you anymore. And I think that's the state of the nation right now in the U.S. We're so different. Our potentates in D.C., what I like to call Mordor on the Potomac, can no more tell me how to do things well in Arizona than they can in Montana, or even regulating the crime that occurs on the streets outside of their buildings.
Well, they're too busy telling us about swine flu.
Yes.
Well, Bill Buport, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show this morning. Everybody, take a look at his archive on lewrockwell.com. Bill, keep writing about secession. I want to highly recommend his fictional look, maybe not so fictional look, at a future America, a secessionist America. Bill, keep writing, and thank you.
Well, thank you. Lou, may I add one thing, if I may?
Please, yes.
I do think that the thing we need to do is not so much communicate with our Congress critters, but try to get involved. If you want to get involved in politics, and I have to say I've become rather agnostic about that, if you do, get involved within your own respective state and get people who are friendly to the notion of independence than dependence.
Well, I'm going to just give a slight dissent on that question. And
okay.
This is from somebody who used to be involved in politics before I went straight. But really, I think it, by and large, and the one exception is always Ron Paul. But except for Ron Paul putting some political creep in office versus another political creep, I think my guess is it's a waste of time. But I'll tell you what's not a waste of time and what you have total control over, and that's yourself. And you can educate yourself, see how Bill Buport has done it. You can learn everything you can learn about the subject, whether it's secession or Austrian economics or the Federal Reserve or a million and one other important topics. You can learn so much about it that people will come to you because of your knowledge, and you will actually have influence on them. But again, you control what you put into your own head, and you have no control over anything anybody in the government does, but you do have control over yourself, so start from there. And again, if you enjoy politics, if it's fun for you, if you want to be involved in it, I certainly agree that one should do the local thing and forget national politics. But to me, the first thing, far more important than politics, is read things by Bill Buport and read other things on secession and all the other important topics. And to me, that's the way to revolution.
Well, thanks, Lou, and you and I will continue to witness then.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. Thanks for listening.